I'm William O'Flaherty. Thanks for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. All About Jack is also part of the Theology Mix Network. Today is another special edition. That is, I'm not doing my typical interview with a book author. Instead, I'm featuring portions of some talks given at the recent 2016 Inklings Week in Oxford that I attended in July. What follows are either 5 or 10 minute portions of 7 talks from that event. If you were present at St. Giles Church, where nearly all of the main activities occur, then you know that there were actually 15 presentations, plus a speaker at each of the short morning worship times. So why only highlight 7 talks? The reason is that I limited my selection to content that most directly related to the life and writings of C.S. Lewis. So while all talks were very interesting and had some connection to Lewis, I needed to make some artificial division. The excerpts you will hear from shortly include parts of what Walter Hooper, Michael Ward, and Colin Duryea said. Next, you might wonder why only 10 minutes of some and 5 for others and how that decision was made. Well, I felt it best to give all the highlights in one podcast, so that's part of why I'm only sharing about 1/6 of each talk, and that partly answers why only 5 minutes for some of them. Those that you will hear only 5 minutes of came from speakers that did a 30-minute presentation versus the plenary talks that were an hour. Why not have several shows of highlights? Well, the main purpose of this podcast is to remind those who attend it what it was like to attend and to develop interest in those who did not go so they would consider catching the next event, which is planned for 2019. Additionally, if you live near enough to or can travel to Montreat, North Carolina, there is an annual weekend event held around the 1st of April. There's just a couple of other things to note. One is that while good quality equipment was used to record the talks, I was unable to tie into the sound system, and so because the church was built centuries ago, it had natural acoustics that made recording the way I did subpar. However, I believe that the minor echo and background hiss will not be too distracting to hear the majority of what is said. Second is the fact that it is hoped that videos of all the talks will be made available on YouTube in the near future. In fact, one is already posted so far as this episode is first posted. There's a link in the show notes for it. Having said that, some of the speakers did request that their talk only be made available to those who attend it. Either way, you can check the All About Jack YouTube channel to find out what videos are publicly available, and participants will be contacted directly to learn of other videos. There is also a link to the All About Jack YouTube channel in the show notes that I will detail how to get to at the end of the podcast. Finally, here's a complete list of speakers and the topics. Plus, between each speaker, there will be musical transition, and I will remind you of the speaker's name. First up will be Walter Hooper. His topic is 50 Years with C.S. Lewis. Second is Don King on Warney Lewis, followed by Holly Ordway, who is discussing Charles Williams. Fourth is Michael Ward, who spoke on The Last Battle, 60 Years On. Fifth is Hal Poe on Lord David Cecil, who was one of the Inklings. Sixth is a talk from Rebecca Poe Hayes about another Inkling, Neville Coghill. And finally, Colin Duryea spoke on J.R.R. Tolkien and the Shadow of War. As mentioned, Walter Hooper's presentation kicks things off.
When Hal Poe gave me the title 50 Years of C.S. Lewis, I remembered one of the most difficult questions I've ever been asked. In order to understand the question, I've mentioned that a few years ago I was invited to Bratislava to give some talks on C.S. Lewis to students of the Narnian Elementary School and the bilingual C.S. Lewis High School. I hardly knew where Bratislava was until I went there. But what I found, I will never forget. The sacrifices the faculty and students made for the Christian faith and their love and admiration for the writings of C.S. Lewis were the most humbling experiences ever to come my way. I owe the people I met in those schools more than I can ever express. On the last day there, 13th May 2010, the last question I was asked came from a teenage girl who said, "How does it feel having spent your life under the shadow of someone else?" Let me repeat that. How does it feel having spent your life under the shadow of someone else? Now, to go back to 1963 and the year of C.S. Lewis's death, it was shortly after I became Lewis's secretary and moved into the curates that Lewis spent part of the July in the Acton nursing home, and it was during that time that I came to know one of the most surprising things about his private life. It was through answering Lewis's correspondence with his lawyer friend, Owen Barfield, that I learned of Lewis's extraordinary generosity. From the time Lewis began making money from his Christian writings, beginning with the serialization of the Screwtape Letters in 1941, and later the radio talks that same year, which were published as Mere Christianity, Lewis refused to touch a penny of it. Instead, he sent the publishers and the BBC a list of widows and orphans and directed that the money be sent to them. Lewis did not understand the difference between gross and net profit. And in the spring of 42, he discovered to his horror that he owed a hefty tax bill on monies he'd given away. Before things got out of hand, his friend Owen Barfield intervened and helped Lewis set up a charitable trust called the Agape Fund, or Argy-Pargy, as they call it. Thereafter, until Lewis's marriage in 1957, Lewis had two-thirds of his income paid into the Argy-Pargy for the supplying of anonymous gifts to various people in need, but especially widows and orphans. The Agape Fund was restored after Joy died in 1960 and was continuing. When I consider how much Lewis was giving away, two things flashed through my mind. One was the poorness, almost the poverty that Lewis lived in at the Kills. When I arrived there, I discovered that almost everybody smoked, but there was only one ashtray in the house. I had to beg Lewis to allow me to buy several cheap ones to litter about the place to avoid the house catching fire. The new ashtrays went unnoticed. Lewis then always flicked his ashes across the rug in his study. "Ashes are good for rugs," he said, "but only men believe it." I learned, too, that when the new housekeeper, Mrs. Miller, moved to the Kills in 1952, she found the blackout curtains still up. These coarse black curtains had been necessary during wartime, but the war had long been over. And Mrs. Miller asked Lewis if the curtains couldn't be replaced. He saw no reason to waste money on curtains. "In that case," asked Mrs. Miller, "would he mind if she washed them?" Luckily, in the course of being washed, the blackout curtains dissolved into ink and had to be poured out. The Kills got new curtains. In talking with Lewis about the Agape Fund, I realized that he was not altogether comfortable at ending it when he married. But Owen Barfield assured him that it had been necessary. I, for my part, knowing what a plain, almost threadbare life he lived, was stunned that he had been so extremely generous. 2/3 of his income. Why, I asked plainly, did you give away so much? The simplicity of his answer took my breath away. God was so good in having me, he said, that the least I could do was to give away most of what I made in his name. When was the last time we said, God was so good in having me? When was the last time I said that? At this time, Lewis's beloved brother, Warnie, a retired army officer, had been in Ireland for several months, and Jack was very worried about him. Warnie was given to binges, and beginning in 1947, every time he went on a binge, he retreated to Drogheda, County Louth, where he stayed with Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital. Jack was worried about what his brother would live on when he, C.S. Lewis, died. That's simple, I said. He'll live on your royalties. Jack went on to say he was sure that upon his death, his books would stop selling after 3 years. No, I explained. What do you mean, no? He said. This happens, he said, to nearly all authors. After they die, their books stop selling, sell for a while, and then trail off to nothing. But not yours. Why not? He asked. Because they are too good, and people are not that stupid. There was no false modesty about Lewis. Writing to his American admirer and benefactor, Dr. Warfield Fireall, on 20 December 1951, he said, I am going to be, if I live long enough, one of those men who was a famous writer in his 50s and 40s and 50s and dies unknown, like Christian going down into the green valley of humiliation. When I agreed to be Lewis's secretary on a permanent basis, I had to return to the United States to teach one final term and resign my job at the University of Kentucky. Then on 22 November 1963, President J.F. Kennedy was assassinated. Hours after learning of his death, I was told that C.S. Lewis had died the same hour. I can hardly bear to think about that terrible day. Lewis had been the center of my life since I first came across his writings in 1953. And during the months we were together, I had come to love him. Now everything seemed lost. However, as things settled down, I received a letter from those friends of Lewis's I had come to know best during the summer of 63, Dr. Austin Farrer, the warden of Keble College, and his wife, Catherine. The Farrer's brother was a work for me to do in Oxford, and they urged me to come back, staying with them in Keble College. I took them at their word and returned to Oxford in January 1964. But what was this work I was needed for? I would soon find out. Meanwhile, while a guest of the Farrers in Keble College, I soon came to know Lewis's brother, Warnie. To avoid confusion, I will give them the names that friends used. C.S. Lewis was called Jack, and Warren Lewis was called Warnie. While my loss was perhaps nothing compared to Warnie's, we met as friends both of whom who had lost a great deal. Over time, I realized that although Warnie was 4 years older than Jack, his dependence on Jack made him in some ways the younger of the two. Certainly what Jack said about the death of his mother when they were children was true again for Warnie. There was to be no more of the old security. It was sea and islands now. The great continent had sunk like Atlantis. Warnie could have remained at the Kills. This was the home for
Don King.
From the effects of World War I. Warren Lewis, as did many of the Inklings, he experienced firsthand the global collapse of Victorian and Edwardian culture. And as he served on the battlefield during World War I, he certainly saw the most extreme cases of the human image being discarded. He has a lot to share with us this morning. So today, we'll look at one of the Inklings, and it's Warren Lewis during World War I. The mind-numbing butchery of World War I is without equal in the history of warfare, so grotesque that it borders on being an outrage to the imagination. Estimates place the number killed on the battlefield at 8,750,000, including 750,000 British soldiers, with another 21 million individuals wounded or diseased. I mean, think about that for a minute. 30 million people directly affected by World War I. Even those of us brought up on World War II, Vietnam, and the Gulf Wars, wars with their own particular nightmares of death, recoil at this incredible loss of life and the seemingly absurd battlefield tactics. As Paul Fussell puts it in The Great War in Modern Memory, every war is ironic because every war is worse than expected. And that was certainly true of World War I. Warren thought the war would be over by Christmas. It started August 4th, 1914. He thought it would be over by Christmas. It went on for another 4 years. But if what Fussell says is true, then World War I suggests it is one of history's greatest ironies. After more than 4 years of service in their shared nightmare of the Great War, Warren Lewis recounts the memorable day on December 27, 1918, that he and his brother, C.S. Lewis, were finally reunited. And so this is from his diary. A red letter day today. We, he and his father, Albert, we're sitting in the study at about 11 o'clock this morning when we saw a cab coming up the avenue. It was Jack's. He's been demobilized, thank God. Needless to say, there were great doings. He is looking quite fit. We had lunch and then all three went for a walk. It was as if the dream of 4 years had passed away and we were still in the year 1915. Although a good deal has been written about C.S. Lewis and his wartime service, much less has been written about Warren's involvement in World War I. We know the basic outline of Warren's military service during the Great War, including the dates of his various postings, the record of the divisions that he served with, and the dates of his several promotions. However, this outline does not really address important matters related to his service. For instance, what branch of the British Army did he serve in? What were his everyday duties as an officer? What were his ambitions for promotion? How did his attitude toward the war change? When was he under active fire and how did he respond? How did he react to his brother's decision to fight? And what were his fears once his brother was directly involved in battlefield action? Perhaps most importantly, what were the most important things he took away from service during the Great War, the things that he carried with him for the rest of his life? Fortunately, we have two critical primary sources available that can help answer some of these questions. The extensive letters that Warren wrote to his father Albert and Albert's replies, as well as an extensive diary that Warren Lewis kept from 1918, January 1, December 18, 1918 to December, through December 1918. In light of these two resources, as well as Warren's service records and other related war writings, this morning I'm going to attempt to answer some of the questions I've posed, all with a view of trying to offer a more comprehensive view of Warren's life and service during World War I. And I should say that this is an excerpt from the second chapter of the biography that I'm working on Warren Lewis. So I'll pick up with when Warren first goes over. On October the 2nd, 1914, from the base depot in France, Warren writes his first letter to his father after being commissioned as a second lieutenant. Warren writes, "Here am I, Second Lieutenant W.H. Lewis of the Army Service Corps, sitting in the anteroom after mess, writing you an epistle. Doesn't it seem too good to be true? Thank you very much for the wires you sent me, but especially for the one of congratulation. I am very, very glad to have relieved you to a large extent of the anxiety for the future by my getting into the ASC. Although at a time like this, it was a bit of a wrench to put down for it instead of one of the fighting us. Although Warren in this letter expresses some misgivings about not having sought to fight or to serve in a fighting unit, his delight with the situation overcomes any second thoughts. Like thousands of other subalterns, and a subaltern was a junior officer below the rank of captain, Warren was excited finally to be on the field. What was the Army Service Corps? In brief, the ASC was responsible for keeping the British Army supplied with its provisions. Hundreds of tons of equipment, ammunition, and food had to be loaded, moved, unloaded, and distributed every day to keep the men at the front fed and armed. The Army Service Corps were responsible for keeping the horses and the lorries on the road as they carried supplies from bases along the French coast to the front line. Among other things, it was responsible for land, coastal, and lake transport, air dispatch, barracks administration, the Army Fire Service, staffing headquarters units, supply of food, water, fuel, and domestic materials, such as clothing, furniture, and stationery, and the supply of technical and military equipment. I'm just tired reading all of those responsibilities. By the way, some of the men serving on the front lines accused the men serving in the ASC as being jam stealers. In fact, that was sort of their nickname. Well, if you're short of ammunition or of grub you're wanting more, the boys you're looking out for are the Army Service. So you can see, at the beginning of the war, they moved 842,000 gallons of gasoline. By the end of the war, they were moving 13 million gallons. So just an incredible amount of work that had to be done. Like other new recruits, Warren spent his initial training at the La Havre Base Depot and then transferred to the Advanced Depot at Rouen for posting. During his training, Warren received instruction in, and I think this is somewhat comical, horse riding, driving, drills and general duties in addition to passing through the prescribed courses, and he underwent practical courses of instruction in the farriers, wheelers, and saddlers' shops. It may surprise some that part of Warren's initial training included horse riding and related skills. However, the ASC was organized into four sections: horse transport, mechanical transport, supply, and remount. Warren's posting to the 4th Company, 7th Divisional Train on November the 4th, 1914, was to a horse transport division. This means he had to have some level of knowledge and expertise regarding horses. I think the comedy was C.S. Lewis and his father talking about Warren riding a horse. Over 53,000 riding and draft horses were used with the British Expeditionary Force by the time Warren reached France. I think most of us don't think of World War I as being a war where horses were involved, but they certainly were. Really, not until the last year of the war was there much mechanized movement. in terms of land movement, certainly there was rail movement. Now, such a large number of animals meant that a good deal of time, money, and effort went into the caring for them. Warren gives us some idea of this when he recounts a typical daily routine in a letter to his father. He writes, "The weather here is desperately cold and wet, a very serious thing for horses which are in the open. However, we have only lost one through pneumonia in the last 10 days. The captain and myself have managed to get our charges stabled in a ruined cottage where they are very comfortable. We patched up the roof and managed to find enough straw to bed them down every night. We are now putting up elaborate horse lines in the field for the company of horses." Before examining more closely Warren's initial field experience with the ASC, it's important to note a consistent caution given him by his father: excessive use of alcohol. This is Albert writing. "I don't want to preach, Warnie, but there's another thing I've got to say, not only as a father to a dear son, but as one good friend to another. The army is a profession of pitfalls. You must know something of them. Perhaps you've already seen the broken and ruined bodies of what might have been good men lying in them. I've already spoken to you of the dangers of drink, and you've given me a promise. Recollect that it's the beginning of these things that have to be avoided. There are two simple truths that one should always remember. Drink is stronger than the strongest man, and once you begin, it's hard to stop." A month later, Albert repeats this warning after receiving a letter from Warren in which Warren boasts about having sat along a boulevard cafe drinking gin and smoking French cigarettes. Albert writes, "Sitting on the boulevard smoking cigarettes and drinking gin is a very great stunt, but an old chum may give a young man a word of advice. Have little or nothing to do with gin. For a young man, it is not only unnecessary, it is absolutely injurious. It prevents him from doing his best by the reaction afterward, either mentally or physically. And in addition, there's a horrible risk. It's so easy to contract the habit. And if it grips a man, the consequence is damnation in this world and the next. Gambling may ruin a man's estate, and he may recover. Women may ruin a man's health, and he, broken with disease, may die in penitence and self-reproach. But drink is the most dangerous and most enslaving of all the vices." Now, notwithstanding Albert's warnings, as most of us know, Warren eventually became an alcoholic. Were these early warnings unintended catalysts of Warren's illness, or did Albert see early on that his son was constitutionally prone to an excessive use of alcohol? I can't answer those questions. I hope to answer some of them by the time I finish writing.
Holly Ordway.
Glad to be here. So I'm speaking today, this morning, a short talk on Charles Williams, who is a lesser known of the Inklings. Tolkien once described Charles Williams as a comet that appeared out of the blue, passed through the little provincial Oxford solar system, and went out again into the unknown. And as Williams appeared in this way to the Inklings, so too has he appeared to many readers since then, as an eccentric, provocative figure. One could say that Williams created a mythopoetic atmosphere for his own life. He signed his letters Under the Mercy. He founded the Order of the Companions of the Coherence. He wrote elaborate masks, these plays for his colleagues at the Oxford University Press that infused their working world with pomp and ritual. And he even gave new names to all of his friends and colleagues. Charles Williams's novels are also very strange, like the man himself. The novels are intriguing, but they're also unsettling, even at times disturbing. Though they are difficult to understand, they do reward attentive reading, but they also require discernment so as not to be drawn off into unorthodox or unhealthy directions. William's writing, again, like Williams himself, is a very complex topic. And so in this brief talk, I'm only going to give an overview of his place in the Inklings and of his novels. Williams and Lewis first encountered each other through their writing. In the spring of 1936, Lewis picked up a copy of Williams' novel, The Place of the Mind, published in 1931, and was so impressed that he wrote a fan letter to Williams. He wrote, "A book sometimes crosses one's path, which is so like the sound of one's native language in a strange country that it feels almost uncivil not to wave some sort of flag in answer. I have just read Your Place of the Lion, and it is to me one of the major literary events of my life, comparable to my first discovery of George MacDonald, G.K. Chesterton, or William Morris." At the same time, Williams, working at Oxford University Press, had been reading the proofs for Lewis's book, The Allegory of Love. He wrote in admiration to Lewis, saying, "My dear Mr. Lewis, if you had delayed writing another 24 hours, our letters would have crossed. It has never before happened to me to be admiring an author of a book while he, at the same time, was admiring me. My admiration for the staff work of the omnipotence rises every day." Now, from this beginning of mutual admiration for each other's writing came an immediate friendship. Then, in 1939, during the Blitz, Oxford University Press moved its London staff to Oxford for safety. Williams was quickly made welcome by the Inklings in Oxford, and he was a member of the Inklings until his untimely death in 1945. When Williams arrived in Oxford, both Lewis and Tolkien arranged for him to be able to lecture at the university, despite the fact that Williams did not have a college degree. Williams was popular with students, and he was recognized for his insights into Milton's poetry in particular. In fact, Lewis acknowledges his debt to Williams in Lewis's own book, A Preface to Paradise Lost. Williams had a powerful personal magnetism and was, in fact, more accustomed to having disciples than colleagues. Lewis quickly became one of Williams's admirers, as much as the young women who flocked to Williams' lectures. Indeed, the continued interest in Williams' work over the last 60-odd years is likely due in no small part to Lewis's enthusiasm. Lewis edited a collection of essays in honor of Williams. After his friend's untimely death, he wrote a substantial piece on Williams's Arthurian poetry to go along with Williams' essay, Arthurian Torso and the Unfinished Poems. And Lewis named the novel Descent into Hell as one of the 10 most influential books in his life. So we can see that Williams was able to enter into the world of the Inklings as a fellow academic in a certain sense, but not completely. As Lewis commented, he is largely a self-educated man, laboring under an almost oriental richness of imagination, clotted glory from Charles, as Dyson called it, which could have been saved from turning silly or even vulgar by a severe early discipline which he never had. As a young man, Williams had begun to study at University College London.
Michael Ward.
I want to speak to you about The Last Battle. It is the 60th anniversary of its publication. It first came before the public in 1956, the concluding volume in the Seven Chronicles of Narnia. And as William also mentioned, I have developed an interpretative approach to these books based on Lewis's lifelong fascination with the seven heavens of the medieval cosmos. Let us remind ourselves of these seven heavens. It's the seventh of the seven heavens that I want to speak to you about today, because I believe it is out of the symbolism of Saturn that Lewis constructed so much of The Last Battle. And given that The Last Battle is all about the global collapse of Narnian culture, it seemed to be a doubly appropriate topic on which to speak today. So here are the seven heavens. This is the model of the cosmos that was believed to be hard, reliable, established scientific fact until the 16th century, when Nicholas Copernicus came along and blew it out of the water with his heliocentric theory of the cosmos. And you see how if you keep going up through the seven heavens, you eventually emerge out of the created order altogether into the very home of God. You see Habitaculum Dei et Omnium Electorum around the edge there, the home of God and all the elect. You know Lewis's book, The Discarded Image. He called it The Discarded Image because this is the image we have discarded. We no longer believe the universe to be like this. Except in one respect, of course, we retain an awareness of this old cosmos when we refer any day of our lives to the names of the days of the week. Because, of course, it is after these seven heavens that we name the days of the week. What's today? Is it Thursday? So today is Thor's Day in Roman, if you're thinking in Roman, in Norse terms, but if you think in Roman terms, the equivalent of Thor in Roman mythology is Jove, or Jupiter, which in Spanish gives us jueves, or in French, jeudi. Here's a medieval illustration from the Divine Comedy, perhaps the greatest poem of the Middle Ages. Lewis said that the Paradiso, the third part of the Divine Comedy, was the highest point that poetry had ever reached. And in the Paradiso, the third canticle of the Divine Comedy, the pilgrim mounts up through the seven heavens in his ascent to God's throne. So here you see the seven planetary characters in the order of the days of the week, from Sunday in his burning fiery chariot all the way through to Saturn on the far right. You see Saturn there with his sickle. Saturn was associated with death, disaster, old age, pestilence. He is the same character, mythologically speaking, Lewis says in the discarded image, as Father Time. Father Time, with his scythe and his hourglass, is based on earlier pictures of Saturn. Now, Lewis said that the characters of the planets seem to me to have a permanent value as spiritual symbols, which is especially worthwhile in our own generation. Of Saturn, we know more than enough, but who does not need to be reminded of Jove? This is a very important quotation, if you ask me. Lewis is saying of these seven heavens that they're not just a medieval curiosity. They are rather a useful way of dividing up spiritual reality into seven segments. It's a little bit like the spectrum of the rainbow. You can go all the way through life, as it were, slotting in your spiritual experience to one or other of these seven departments. You could start out, for instance, understanding the beginning of your life in terms relating to Venus associated with life and fertility, all the way through to Saturn, associated with death and disaster. And indeed, these spiritual symbols, Lewis says, are especially worthwhile in his own generation, because his own generation, of course, was the generation that went through the First World War. That's why he says, of Saturn we know more than enough. In Lewis's generation, they knew more than enough about the Saturnine influence. 750,000 British servicemen were killed during the First World War. Lewis himself, as you are well aware, was very nearly one of them. But Lewis thought that the Saturnine influence cast over his generation was a historical accident. It wasn't an eternal truth about the nature of the universe. And a much better way of symbolizing the heart of spiritual reality from his Christian point of view was through the symbolism of Jove, Jupiter. Jupiter is the king, a festive, tranquil, magnanimous symbol of God's kingship. So when Lewis began writing The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I believe, he wrote that in order to suggest symbolically, atmospherically, through the plot and through the background descriptions and through the manner of the portrayal of Aslan, this whole jovial personality, as it were, the whole story being infused with a jovial flavor or tone. Eventually, he decided he would write a book for each of the seven heavens, and of course, the obvious one to finish with is Saturn. So the last battle is, I believe, Lewis's Saturnine story. We've seen that Saturn is an old man with a beard and a sickle, but let's just remind ourselves a little bit more of the particular qualities associated with Saturn. Lewis writes about the seven heavens in a number of places. Chapter 5 of The Discarded Image, chapter 15 of That Hideous Strength, and his long poem, The Planets, which he wrote 15 years before he published The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So I want to quote you now the lines detailing Saturnine influence in his Planets poem. This is how it begins. Up beyond Jupiter goes Saturn, silent in the seventh region, the skirts of the sky. Scant grows the light, sickly, uncertain, the sun's finger daunted with darkness. Distance hurts us, and the vault severe of vast silence, where fancy fails us, and fair language, and love leaves us, and light fails us, and Mars fails us, and the mirth of Jove is as tin tinkling. In tattered garment, weak with winters, he walks forever a weary way wide round the heaven, stooped and stumbling, with staff groping, the Lord of Lead. He is the last planet, old and ugly. His eye fathers pale pestilence, pain of envy, remorse and murder. Melancholy drink, for bane or blessing, of bitter wisdom he pours for his people. A perilous draught that the lip loves not. We leave all things to reach the rim of the round welkin, heaven's hermitage high and lonely. So you see here how most of the Saturnine qualities have negative associations. But there is one respect in which Saturn has a positive influence, according to medieval thought. You see here, his drink is drunk for bane or blessing. Most of the Saturnine influence is baneful. But there is one blessing to be achieved under Saturn. And that is the gift of contemplative wisdom. In the Divine Comedy, Dante puts into the sphere of Saturn those who have acquired this contemplative gift. Above the orbit of the moon, it was believed that there was nothing essentially maleficial, nothing essentially bad. So this influence of Saturn, it could not be essentially bad. It's just bad because we find it difficult to make good use of. It's a little bit like the martial influence. Under the influence of Mars, we become either violent, brutal, cruel warriors, or on the other hand, gallant, chivalrous, self-disciplined, courageous knights. And the proper response to a martial influence is to become a knight, not to become Attila the Hun. Likewise, under Saturn, the proper response to the apparently negative influences that he sheds upon your life is to become wise, to become truly contemplative, to see beyond surface realities with a wise spiritual insight, penetrating the superficial appearances to the contrary into the heart of blessing. All things work together for good for those who love God. Finally, in the ultimate analysis, God wishes to bless us, even though on the surface there may be some very negative things we have to get through first. But if we keep moving through the Saturnine sphere, we eventually emerge, as I've said, into the home of God. We reach the rim of the round welkin, heaven's hermitage, high and lonely. But we have to keep moving. I think it was Churchill who said, when you're going through hell, keep going. Do not stop. If you keep going through hell, you may eventually emerge out the other side. Indeed, this is a message we could derive from the Divine Comedy itself.
Hal Poe.
third one that we don't seem to talk about very much is Lord David Cecil. Lord David Cecil belonged to arguably the most prominent political family in Britain of the last 500 years. It's a family that produced four prime ministers, always called prime minister. William Cecil Ward Burghley was that most important advisor to Elizabeth I. His younger son, Sir Robert Cecil, filled that role for King James I. And Lord David's grandfather, who was the third Marquess of Salisbury, was three times Prime Minister to Queen Victoria. And it isn't just that there were these four prominent figures. Everybody else did something. Cecil's father was not Prime Minister, but he was a cabinet member, which is pretty good. His brother was not cabinet rank, but he was the second tier, the assistant minister. And so in public service, they were one of those families that always embodied that sense of obligation and duty. And they also were an unusual noble family in their continuing piety from generation to generation. They were, have been historically a family of faith. And that certainly came through with Lord David. Lord David produced a substantial body of work. During his day, when the Inklings were meeting in the 1940s, and even in the 1930s, David Cecil would have been the famous member of the group. So let that sink in. He was the famous member because of all of his connections, but because of his writing. And he wrote a number of things. One of his books, his biography of Lord Melbourne. Melbourne was Victoria's first prime minister. Was John Kennedy's favorite book. John Kennedy kept that biography on his bedside table. And Cecil had a wonderful writing style. But he embodied something that Lewis talked about in an essay on Christian apologetics. And in that essay on Christian apologetics, Lewis goes off on a tangent for a moment, and he said, now the best apologetics are not little Christian books, but they're little books on every subject, any subject, with the Christianity latent. And Cecil was a master at that. He understood what his faith had to do with everything. And so it was not artificially drawn in. It was synthetically an aspect of what he was talking about. I'll give you a few examples of that in a little bit. This is in my collection. It's his resume that he typed up himself and signed. And it's rather modest. It's just a brief little thing. His universe, but he had a sense of humor, a grand sense of humor. And so notice what he says about himself. His university lectures, his radio talks, and his written essays are all distinguished and by impeccable scholarship and a felicitous style. So you have to understand, tongue in cheek, wink, wink, my impeccable scholarship. And Notice what he considers his most important work. Historical biographer William Lamb Culper, his first book was about a biography of the hymnist and poet Culper, the evangelical hymnist. Sir Walter Scott, Jane Austen, men of the RAF, and Thomas Hardy. Okay, that's a wide range of interests and ideas. There's his grandfather, the Prime Minister. There's the family pile. Hatfield House. Hatfield House had been a royal palace. Queen Mary kept her half-sister, the Princess Elizabeth, imprisoned at Hatfield House. So, and it was at Hatfield House that Elizabeth learned that she was the new queen. After that, it was no longer a place she cared to visit. Her heir and cousin, James of Scotland, when he ascended to the throne, he gave Hatfield House to his prime minister, Robert Cecil. And so that branch of the Cecil family has had Hatfield House ever since. But this is where he grew up. You know, it's a little different from Little Lee, Lewis's home. So he went to Eton and then to Oxford. He was at Christ Church. How many folks have had a chance to meet by Christ Church?
Rebecca Poe Hayes.
A good teacher is by watching a master teacher at work. And I think that Neville Coghill is probably one of those masters. So for the next few minutes, I'm going to try and paint a picture of who Professor Coghill was and how he engaged his subject, his students, and his friends. On a warm July evening in 1933, the two Lewis brothers drove down the hill from Headington to dine at Exeter College as guests of their friends Hugo Dyson and J.R.R. Tolkien. Because it was vacation time, the party ate supper not in the Great Hall, but in the Commons Room. Warney settled in next to Tolkien to eat a summer-appropriate meal of cold soup, lobster salad, and cider. But he later wrote in his diary that he should have liked to have seen more of the man on the opposite side of the table, whom Warney described as big, pleasant, good-looking in a sort of musical comedy kind of way, except for a vicious mouth. This man was Neville Coghill, and though he was a new face to Warney, he had been friends with Jack Lewis for over a decade at this point. The two had first met during Michaelmas term in 1922. They were in a discussion class together, and they had a common tutor in F.P. Wilson, kept them basically in step so far as what they were reading, which allowed for long walks and animated discussions about the texts for that week. From the beginning, they recognized in one another a kindred spirit. They shared a sharp intellect, but more than that, they shared a love for poetry and the desire to be poets, and for epic literature on a grand scale. They also shared a dislike for modern verse, as has already been mentioned. At one point, they came up with this plan to make fun of T.S. Eliot and his poetry, and so they wrote all these parody poems under the names of Rollo and Bridget Considine. They got this group together and wrote these fake poems. They were going to send them in to T.S. Eliot, to this journal, to see if he would publish them as serious poetry. They thought that was hilarious. I don't think they ever actually sent them in, but they wrote them, I think. So both would join Tolkien's Coalbiter Club, whose name comes from an Icelandic term meaning men who lounge so close to the fire in winter that they bite the coal. In this case, the men lounged around reading Old Norse literature. While Coghill and Lewis knew no Icelandic, they were enthusiastic beginners, and so they took up their dictionaries to join in the work of translating the text for the evening. Like most foreign language reading groups today, if y'all have ever been in a Hebrew class or Greek or Spanish or whatever, some of the group tried to cheat at the translation. So one of the members later told the story of a certain scholar who must remain nameless, was actually caught using a printed crib sheet under the table as he translated his passage, apparently impromptu. He was not invited back again. Coghill and Lewis also had an Irish upbringing in common, that they hailed from very different parts of that island. Whereas Lewis was born in the northern city of Belfast, Coghill was raised in a coastal village in County Cork in the south. Geography rendered this village relatively isolated and necessarily self-sufficient. Coghill was the younger son of a local Anglo-Irish aristocracy. One of Neville's childhood friends described Neville's mother as ruling over their seaside community with an acute sense of humor and a talent for storytelling. Neville seems to have inherited a bit of this ability. A friend would later comment that Coghill's instinctive flair for timing and situation was just innate Irishness. Neville's father, Sir Egerton, had studied art in Paris, and Neville would one day decorate his rooms in Oxford with several of his paintings. The entire family was artistically minded, with cousins, aunts, and uncles gifted as writers, painters, photographers, and musicians. Neville himself proved to be a talented violinist, and he would later comment that if it hadn't been for the Great War, he might have become a professional violinist rather than an Oxford don. But the Great War did happen. Coghill, along with all his friends, left school at Haileybury to join the Special Reserve Royal Field Artillery as young officers. His brother Paddy, already a regular army officer, sent Neville off with the shrewd advice to never volunteer for anything. He said they don't have lots of stories of Neville during the war, but one of the ones he tells is this awkward situation where they were calling for volunteers and he kept trying to not volunteer, and it got really awkward and ended up volunteering. Unlike Lewis and Tolkien, who served in the trenches of France, Coghill was sent to the Balkans, to what was known as the Macedonian Front. Allied forces held this front roughly following Greece's northern border until 1918. When they pushed north into Serbia and forced Bulgarian and Hungarian surrenders. One of Coghill's students later remarked that Coghill's height, and how remarked on how tall he was, so not me, and how that must have been a danger in the trenches.
Colin Duryea's.
Talking about Tolkien in wartime follows on nicely from Don's talk earlier, where we got that beautiful micro context of the First War through Warren Lewis. This is a quotation from Tolkien's preface to the new edition of The Lord of the Rings in 1966. An author, he writes, cannot of course remain wholly unaffected by his experience. One has indeed personally to come under the shadow of war to feel fully its oppression. But as the years go by, it seems now often forgotten that to be caught in youth by 1914 was no less hideous an experience than to be involved in 1939 and the following years. By 1918, all but one of my close friends was dead. On August 4th, 1914, Germany invaded Belgium and Britain declared war. Between 1914 and 1918, the war took in most of Europe, along with Russia, the United States, later in the war, the Middle East, and other areas of the world. Before being dwarfed by the savagery of the Second World War, it ranked as one of the most destructive and horrific wars in history. It resulted in the collapse of four imperial dynasties, revolution in Russia, and created the conditions which eventually led to World War II. It was the first global war in the history of humanity. The following year, 1915, Tolkien completed his studies at Oxford University at Exeter College. He also enlisted with the British Army for wartime service. He had already found the seeds of his lifelong writing about the ages of Middle-earth. As he put it, from rapturous words in an old English poem called Christ, ultimately sprang the whole of my mythology. It's a whole new story about how that happened. On 22nd of March, 1916, he married Edith Bratt in Warwick, near his home city of Birmingham. June 6th saw him landing in France. Years later, remembering in an interview his departure for war, he said, "Parting from my wife, then, we were only just married,
was like a death. This hut here is reconstructed from a massive training camp in Cannock Chase in Staffordshire. It was like a whole town. It had railways and shops and everything like that. And this is typical of the huts that the training soldiers lived in and that Tolkien was in for a while. Tolkien had decided to specialise in military signals, perhaps as a deep-seated reaction against learning the skills of running through someone with a bayonet, grenade throwing and killing in general. It would also increase his chances of survival. Before being posted to France, he had been taught a combination of old and new methods of communication, such as flag, lamp and heliograph, employing Morse and other codes. He also became more familiar with the use of field telephones and signal rockets. The logistics of establishing communication stations, employing dispatch riders, map reading, and running telephone cables came into it. Like all first-timers in the theatre of war, his first destination was Etaple, commonly called by the troops or Tommies as Etaples. Here he received the usual short, sharp shock of final training before moving to the front lines. Tolkien was dismayed that the gear he had to buy at his own cost failed to turn up. He hastily had to procure items such as a sleeping bag, camp bed, and mattress and spare boots. After temporary placement, he was now at last to be with the 11th Battalion of the Lancashire Fusiliers. The battalion was made up of soldiers from a group of northern English towns, including Preston, Blackburn, Burnley, Wigan, Oldham and Bolton. Tolkien felt an affinity with these working men, even though, as an officer, he was forced to keep his distance. Like all officers, Tolkien had a batman to look after him and take care of his kit, and he remarked in later life that the character of the hobbit who accompanied Frodo Baggins on his quest to destroy the ring owed much to his wartime contact with the ordinary Tommy. He says, "My Sam Gamgee is indeed a reflection of the English soldier, of the privates and batmen I knew in the 1914 war, and recognised as so far superior to myself." Tolkien had a group of close friends formed before university at his grammar school in Birmingham. This was King Edward's school. They called themselves the TCBS. This stood for the Tea Club and Barrovian Society, and he referred to their tea club, which met in the Barrow Stores in Birmingham city centre near the school. With Tolkien's arrival in France, three of the TCBS out of the four, including Rob Gilson and a gifted poet called G.B. Smith, were now on the Western Front. In this picture you see Rob Gilson, who was one of the four, with Tolkien in the school days. But this, it's not usual to see a photo of Tolkien this young. Most of the photographs of him were when he was quite old, so it's a fascinating photo. Another of the friends was G.B. Smith, who was a talented poet. Now, of the TCBS, another of the four was Christopher Wiseman, who wasn't at the Western Front, he was with the British Navy. They kept in touch with each other as much as they could. Rob Gilson, who was serving with the Suffolk Regiment, wrote to Tolkien on the 22nd of June. The talk was an Allied offensive, a big push, at the end of June in the vicinity of Elbert, which is on a tributary near the River Somme and close by the front lines. Now, the rumours turned out to be true. In the event, the attack was postponed to the beginning of July. Now, that was July, exactly 100 years ago, and the beginning of the onslaught was a couple of weeks ago, plus 100 years. The attack was postponed, but the Germans got wind of it, and they were prepared for the onslaught. The occasion of Tolkien's arrival in France meant, in fact, that he was in a position with his battalion just in time for one of the greatest battles of the First World War, and one of the bloodiest in casualties. This, of course, is the Battle of the Somme. The battle began on the 1st of July, 1916. When it was over in mid-November, the total Allied gain was about 5 miles at the cost of around 615,000 Allied and about 650,000 German casualties. Of these, nearly 150,000 Allied soldiers were killed or missing, and more than 160,000 of the German forces. Among the enemy injured at the Somme was Corporal Adolf Hitler, who later described the battle as more like hell than war. The Allies expected it to be a decisive breakthrough instead of the dismal stalemate it turned out to be. The Allies' strategy put all their faith in a week-long artillery barrage before their forces advanced. So confident of success with General Haig that troops were ordered to walk slowly towards the enemy lines in close waves. Once these were occupied, the idea was that cavalry units would then surge through in pursuit of retreating Germans. 1.6 million British shells and Allied shells were fired in that relentless barrage. Gielsen described the scene in a letter home shortly before he died. "Guns firing at night are beautiful, if they were not so terrible. They have the grandeur of thunderstorms." On Saturday, 1st of July, the first day of the battle, Rob Gielsen lost his life just after taking over the command of his battalion in No Man's Land. As Gielsen and his men had awaited the 7:30 whistle to advance, they heard birds singing and they saw wildflowers and flowers in woodland and garden flowers around a small chateau. Gielsen was the first of Tolkien's closest friends to die. He was 22. And on the screen you can see the telegram that his father, who was the head teacher at King Edward's School, received. That first day set the theme of futile slaughter. Gielsen was just one of around 20,000 British soldiers who died in the advance that day. A further 40,000 were injured. Of all the officers employed in battle that day, 60% died. Tolkien's battalion was not ordered into action in that first advance, being reserved for later. Because Gielsen's body was not recovered immediately, he was listed as missing for some time. Unaware of their friend's death, G.B. Smith and Tolkien met up several times between the 6th and the 8th of July in Buzenburg, northwest of Alberg, where Tolkien was briefly stationed. According to Humphrey Carpenter, one of Tolkien's biographers, they met and talked as often as they could, discussing poetry, the war, and the future. Once they walked in a field where poppies still waved in the wind. Despite the battle that was turning the countryside into a featureless desert of mud, they were anxious for news of their missing friend. Tolkien's first taste of action took place on the evening of Friday the 14th of July. As he went into the unknown, he now carries the knowledge of Gielsen's death 2 weeks before.
I'm afraid that's where I need to conclude these highlights from the 2016 An Inklings Week in Oxford that was held by the Inklings Fellowship. I'm William O'Flaherty from All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com, which is also part of the Theology Mix Network. Don't forget that in the online show notes, there are links related to this material. There is a link to the video of the initial plenary talk from Hal Poe, not shared in these highlights. It's posted on YouTube. Plus, as other speakers' videos are made publicly available, they will be posted on the All About Jack YouTube channel, and a playlist will be created to help you find them. So there is a link to the YouTube channel in the show notes. Also in the show notes are links to some of the other podcasts where I've previously had some of the speakers on my show. You can find those show notes either at EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast is most easily found and navigated. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. The other location is centralcslewis.com, provides links back to the audio files and also has other features which include a variety of articles related to Lewis. I hope you liked today's show enough to want to share it. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online and consider listening to other shows. At the time this podcast is released, my most recently released new show was my interview with Walter Hooper that was recorded in his home in the afternoon after he spoke in the morning to the group. Also, not long ago, I had Michael Ward on the podcast discussing a book he edited entitled C.S. Lewis at Poet's Corner. In addition to those new shows, you can also find previously released shows on my iTunes feed that you can also find at the Podbean address. If you don't know how to find the show in iTunes, then be sure to check the show notes for a direct link. Again, those notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllaboutJack.podbean.com. If you do visit me via iTunes, please consider rating my podcast, as this can help others to find it there. Finally, let me remind you, or in case you didn't know, I have a book called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. It is available online at Amazon. Paperback is $14.99, and presently the Kindle version is just $5.49. You can learn more about my book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com.